It's now time for the Fantasy 411 podcast.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to the Fantasy 411. I'm Matthew Leach, talking fantasy baseball with MLB.com's lead fantasy writer, Fred Zinke. And we start with something I don't think I thought would have been possible to happen as quickly as it did, but it appears that Aaron Judge has been passed as the story of the MLB season thus far. And maybe even more surprising, he's been passed by another young power hitter. And so with that, we turn our attention to Cody Bellinger, who has been absolutely unbelievable. And the questions we have to ask are the same questions we were asking about Judge a couple of weeks ago. And those are, how highly do you value him for the rest of the year? What would you give up if you were trying to acquire him? What would you be looking for if you had him and were looking to move him? In short, what do we do with this guy who has become one of the most dangerous power hitters in baseball? Where do you kind of have him? Just on a big board right now, where do you have him, Fred?
Yeah, I think he has to be, like, maybe not in with the first-round players yet, but probably right after that in with the, say, second- and third-round type players. You know, doing a little bit of a deeper look at his statistics this season, like, he's hitting .270, which is fine. His BABIP's .286, which is, like, totally something that's sustainable. So he could have an average of .270 or higher the rest of the way. He strikes out a fair amount, but so do a lot of other power hitters. His home run to fly ball percentage is a little over 34, which is high, but not like crazy high like we saw with Gary Sanchez last season. It's something that could come down, but I mean, he doesn't have to hit home runs at the rate he's hitting them right now to still be one of the best home run hitters in baseball. And something really sneaky about Bellinger and Judge, both of them, in a season where we aren't seeing very many stolen bases, they will probably each steal about 10 bags, which really does matter when you compare them to some power hitters who don't steal any.
That's a thing that can really tip it when you're talking about these kinds of guys. And I think one of the things you need to remember, or not you, but you know, players need to remember, is that at that age, that's something you will see once in a while, and it can be an argument for a younger guy. You are never, ever, ever going to see that from, say, Edwin Encarnacion. But, and you know, Albert Pujols was a 10, 15 steal guy at times early in his career. This can happen for young guys. So it's not something that would be shocking, and Bellinger had 10 steals in 2015. To compare him kind of head-to-head to Judge, I think the interesting thing to me is that he did this throughout the minors. I mean, that's to me the thing that really jumps out about Bellinger is he has a 30 home run minor league season. That was the Cal League, and everybody hits in the Cal League, but he has a 30 home run minor league season in a full season high A league at age 19. He has a 26 homer season split between double A and triple A at age 20. You know, this is a guy, Aaron Judge, we talked forever about his raw power, but for the most part in the minors, the power production wasn't quite there. It wasn't lacking. It wasn't like he was hitting 10, 12 home runs a year. But you know, Bellinger is a guy who from the day he got into the minor leagues was hitting for serious power. And that gives me a particular optimism about him going forward, because I don't think there's any reason to doubt that he's a legitimate producing power hitter. And so, look, I'm not down on Judge, but I do expect him to regress some. This is ridiculous. I think it's reasonable to think that Bellinger is at least as good, and if you wanted to make the case better, power source home runs going forward for the rest of the year and future, just because for power production, he's done it more, and he's done it more per at-bat this year than Judge has. Where do you kind of rate those two guys?
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, we forget about Bellinger that he started the season in the minors. Like, it's 22 home runs, and he started the season in the minors. I think where I come in with both of them, I would trade them for like a Nolan Arenado type, like a just an absolute lock stud power hitter, you know, first-round pick type player. Once we get, I would not trade them for the Edwin Encarnacion, that next tier of power hitter. I think if I had Bellinger or Judge, I would just ride it out and see, you know, I would just enjoy the ride because it could be really fun the rest of the way. And I just, I don't think they'll be significantly worse than someone like Encarnacion the rest of the way, to the point where if I made that trade, I'd think, phew, I got out while the getting was good. Whereas they could keep, I don't know if they keep going the way they're going, but they could be much better than some of those veterans from here on out.
And one thing about both these guys is they are in lineups where you're going to have opportunities to drive in runs. They shouldn't just be getting home runs. They should be driving in runs and scoring runs, because these are two pretty good lineups, good opportunities for these guys to produce.
That's right. And teams that are, you know, in the postseason chase that will probably be buyers at the trade deadline. Like their lineup, I could see the Dodgers lineup being better on August 1st than it is now. I think the Yankees lineup, it could be better. It won't be worse. And the Yankees also have prospects. So, I mean, it could be just as good or better also from maybe someone coming up and adding to that lineup like we saw late last year with Sanchez.
Yeah, I mean, I think the one way the Yankees lineup gets better is if they have a functioning Jacoby Ellsbury. Another young-ish, power-ish guy. It's an iffy transition, but we're going to make it anyway. Mike Zunino is once again hitting the cover off the ball, and it's one thing we know he can do. I mean, it's something we've seen him do in the past. Zunino has power, and he gets on these runs. I am not sure I would drop somebody that I had any amount of faith in to get him, but if I had an opening, if I had somebody go on the DL, I'd sure be looking to add him in a shallow league. But I don't think that I'm ready to drop somebody who's pretty good for him, because one thing we've seen from Zunino is that as fast as it can arrive, it can go away that quickly too. And the Mariners historically have not had much hesitation to pull the plug on Zunino when it's going poorly. So I would love to get him if I had an opening. I don't think I'd be giving up on somebody to add him. Do you have more faith in this go-round with Zunino than I do?
No, not really. I think he's going to cool off. But like you said, like the catcher position is so shallow every year that if you can get a catcher who's on fire, you might as well go for it. So I think the best plan of attack for him is not to drop your regular catcher for Zunino. But, I mean, he's already long gone in two catcher leagues. But in one catcher format, I would drop my least valuable other player to put Zunino in my lineup while he's red hot. When he cools down, just go back to the catcher I bench. So if I was using a Russell Martin, a Yadier Molina, a Wellington Castillo, you know, I would be happy to bench one of those players, put Zunino in right now. Maybe that costs me my worst starting pitcher or a backup outfielder who I may be able to pick up again in a few weeks. And like I said, when Zunino cools off and goes back to being a low 200s hitter with some power, at that point, I make the switch back, and hopefully I get some production in the meantime. And maybe the streak goes a little longer than I anticipate.
Yeah. Michael Brantley on the DL has not really been productive when he's played. How deep a league are you willing to just cut bait on Brantley at this point?
I would cut him in a 10-team league. In a 12-team league, I may not cut him. I wouldn't cut him, I think, in a 12-team league, but I would be ready when he comes back, if he had a week or two that was productive, maybe to get ready to trade him. I'd like to go back to something you said about Brantley and players in Brantley's situation. I think back in spring training where you talked about how sometimes they can have that initial surge of adrenaline and therefore production right when they come back, and then that wears off and they, you know, level off a lot more. And that's basically what we saw with him. Like, he hit 5 home runs and had a 916 OPS in April. He has not homered since the beginning of May, and his OPS is in the low 700s. So he's kind of gone back to being a high. He's still hitting for average, but he's gone back to being, say, like a 285 type hitter with very little power who steals a few bases. Well, with all the home runs that are being hit this year, that's not really going to cut it in a 10-team
right.
league, and not even really in a 12-team format.
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing is, to go back to what we talked about, there are some injuries that you really have some confidence that once it's gone, it's gone. You break a bone, you turn an ankle, even muscle injuries, even things like hamstrings, they can certainly recur, but they're not generally things where they linger in the same way. As to me, wrists and shoulders for hitters are things that just you get them as good as you can, but they have a tendency not to get all the way to 100% for a long time, and you start playing baseball on them and it starts wearing them down, and guys start feeling limited or feeling pain, and it becomes problematic. And sometimes you need that full, that second even full off season to get right. You look at a guy like Freddie Freeman with his wrist the last time. Those kinds of injuries, I will never back down from that particular thing. Is it wrists and shoulders, particularly front shoulders for hitters, are things that I will just always find worrisome.
Logan Morrison, go ahead.
He's in a kind of a class of guys this year. There are a few of these guys that are hitting for significant power that you kind of want to trust it, but you're not sure. I probably have him a half a tick down from a guy like Justin Bour, but he keeps doing it. And at some point, you kind of have to trust it to some extent. If I set an over-under for Morrison at 18 home runs the rest of the year, he's at 21 right now. Set an over-under at 18 for him the rest of the year, which is give or take a 27, give or take a 30 home run pace. What are you taking?
I'll take a slight over, I think, on that. Looking at his numbers, like, he's someone who's doing what a lot of hitters have done this year. He's selling out for hard contact. He's selling out for fly balls. You know, he's figured out that, you know, he was already a fairly low average hitter as far as his batting average before this power surge. So he can continue to be a below average batting average hitter, but hit a lot more home runs and make himself much, much more productive. So I think he's found something here. I think you hit the nail on the head where there's so many of these players who have made these adjustments that it's hard for owners to find a way to get them all into lineups, whether it's Justin Bour, Justin Smoke, Yonder, Alonso, you know, Matt Davidson. The list just keeps going. But I think Morrison, like, once we're into 20 homer territory and it's not even the middle of the season, I think it's just a no-brainer. He has to be in a lineup in a shallow league, and then you just, you know, kind of roll with it from there week to week.
In that, and different people would probably define it slightly differently, might not have exactly the same 5, 6, 7 guys, but in that class, Bour is the guy I like the most just because he has sort of, for lack of a better term, the least track record of mediocrity. Morrison might be second for me. Where would you have Morrison in that tier of even now potential cheap power adds?
Yeah, I like Smoke, and I actually like Alonso a lot. The reason I like Alonso is because he can hit for average. He's hitting 300 this season, and he has hit for average in the past. So maybe there's a chance that it just all comes together for him. And Smoke, just being near Toronto and listening to Smoke talk this year, and him maybe understanding himself as a baseball player better than he ever has before. And Smoke's been really consistent this season. Like, this isn't someone who had like a 6-homer week, and that's just because we're still in the first half, that's just propping up his total. Like, Smoke's really gone nicely, like, week to week, game to game. Like, in some games it's a home run, and some games it's just, you know, an RBI double, but they've been really productive on a consistent basis this season.
Another guy having really a breakout part of a season, a guy I've always liked, and I'm glad to see doing this, guy I actually covered when he was in the minors a lifetime ago, Matt Adams. And to me, the thing that jumps out about Adams, his power spike looks really good, and I think we thought at the first he might really be aided by what a friendly place to hit the Atlanta ballpark seems to be. But, you know, I think a thing about Adams is he has previously shown ability to hit for average. He earlier in his career seemed more like a guy who was going to get hits than a guy who was going to hit for a lot of power, despite being a big guy. And now he is doing both, and that really gives me some faith. I'm in on Adams. I buy it as long as he keeps playing. This is a case where you shouldn't just be watching your guy. This is a case where you should be watching all of the news, because it is abundantly clear that the Braves intend to keep playing Adams. They'll think about trading him, I think, if the right offer comes up, if the bottom falls out on them. But it's clear that they intend to keep playing them because they're looking for ways to play him. And there's this new story about Freddie Freeman potentially moving to third base. Freeman says he's game. Even if that doesn't happen, it's a pretty good indication that Matt Adams is not going to go away. So given that, how much do you like Adams for the rest of the year?
Yeah, I like Adams as much as the other players we talked about in that kind of surprising first baseman group. And I think Adams is safer than the other players because Adams hasn't really changed who he is this season. Right. These other guys are taking, like Justin Smoke's like a totally different hitter, and Yonder Alonso, same thing, and Logan Morrison, whereas Adams, like you said, he's done this before. He's a career 273 hitter, so he's someone who's always hit for a decent batting average, and he's had two other seasons where he got over the 15 homer mark in less than 300 at-bats during the season. So he's already shown kind of 25 homer-type power. He just wasn't given the opportunity to get to that 25 homer mark. And I know he's a little better than that right now, but I mean, this is someone who already showed power, who already showed the ability to hit for average. As you said, who his team is locking him into using him for the rest of the season and seems willing to go to great lengths to make that happen. So I think he's less risky than those other emerging first basemen. The playing time was the only risk, and that seems to have disappeared. Whether they could trade him or not, I'm not sure, because there are so many players like him out there right now, but it looks like they don't really want to, like they want to keep him.
Yeah, I think there are two likely outcomes, and one is that Adams remains basically a full-time player for the Braves, and the other is he gets traded. I think the possibility of him seeing his opportunity dwindle is very slim. I mean, I guess one possibility is if a team needed a platoon bat, if a team needed that, that would be the one way you could get hurt. And I don't know exactly what that would look like, but if a contender decided it just needed, you know, a left-handed half of a platoon, you could see that happen. But, you know, I don't think he is going to be playing part-time for the Braves. Zach Cozart goes on the DL. He's been very productive. But, you know, you pointed out in your notes, is he really quite as productive from a fantasy perspective as he looks? I can't part with a guy who has put up the numbers he has, and I have him in an office league. I can't part with him. I can't bring myself to do that even in a 10-team. Are there situations where you would be willing to part with Cozart to pick somebody up rather than absolutely saying I'm holding on to him no matter what?
Yeah, I don't think he's a must-keep for owners who already have a really jammed disabled list. I understand that he'll be kept in most leagues. I mean, he has a 966 OPS this season, which is pretty impressive. And he hits often in front of Joey Votto, also really cool place to bat in around baseball. But, you know, he has a 367 BABIP this season. That's getting close to 100 points higher than his career BABIP. He doesn't steal bases. If his batting average goes back down to where it typically is in his career, which is in the 250s, you know, I do believe there's some power there. Like, I do believe this is someone who could have a 20-homer season. But a 20-homer, 5-steal, 258 batting average season isn't really 10-team league-type material. So it's just how much does anyone believe in that 320 batting average when they look at the BABIP that goes along with it? Has he figured out a way, you know, his career 282 is really low. So has he figured out a way to maintain, like, a little bit of a higher BABIP, put balls into play in a better way, or is this someone who was destined to cool down either way?
Trey Mancini off to a really nice start. And as you note, you know, there are certain places, we've talked about this with the Blue Jays, there are certain places where you have a little more faith in breakouts. You know, there are certain places where guys go and they hit. Baltimore definitely seems to be one of those places, whether it's because of the ballpark, whether it's because of the degree to which they value power, and if you can hit home runs, you're going to play. Whatever the reason, Baltimore is definitely one of those places where if somebody goes there, you sort of take note and you think, I'm going to watch that. And if somebody comes up there and starts hitting, you have a little more faith that it's real. So given all of that, is Mancini one of those guys? Is he a guy where you look at it and say, you know what, this isn't all that surprising. Maybe this is real.
I think it is pretty real. It's just, I think the batting average is high. I don't think he's a 314 hitter. He strikes out a fair amount. He doesn't walk too much. BABIP's high right now. Like, I think he's probably more of a 260 type hitter, but I think the power is real. Now, we've talked a lot today about how many power sources there are out there. To me, Mancini still lags behind all of those other first basemen that we've talked about. Would you take him over any of, like, Alonso, Smoke, Morrison, any of those players?
I don't think so, and I don't know where you'd need to be on that list for me to do it. And one of the things is, you know, he's actually doing all right in this regard, but as powerful as that lineup is, it's not a lineup these days that is filled with guys getting on base. So you do wonder, and it's just kind of a – things aren't going great there, so you do kind of wonder about what comes beyond the home runs. Is he going to have guys to drive in? But, you know, I like him. I certainly – if I had a need and there was an opening, I would add him, but I'm not rushing to add him the way I am some people.
I think he's a 12-team league type of guy, not a 10-team league guy, at least not yet, just because of the lay of the land this season.
Yep. Keon Broxton is having a year that would not look out of place, and I'm going to date myself here. Keon Broxton is having a year that looks right out of the Juan Samuel collection.
Mm-hmm.
He has one of the most fascinating stat lines I have seen in a long time. 98 strikeouts and 18 walks. 11 steals, but caught a league-leading 5 times. 11 homers and 4 triples and 11 doubles, and he scored 40 runs. It's a really weird stat line, and he is a fascinating player, and that adds up to kind of a hard guy to get a fantasy read on. And yet, you kind of look at, you compare it to last year, which is what got everybody excited, and it's really similar. In almost exactly the same number of plate appearances, he has 2 more home runs, 9 more RBI, 12 more runs. His steals are way down. But, you know, in a lot of ways, it's a very similar season to last year. And so I kind of feel like if you liked Broxton coming into the year, you still like Broxton. I mean, is that a fair way to look at it?
Yeah, and I think you just accept the highs and the lows of Broxton. I've talked about this a few times about Chris Davis on the Orioles, where he was a different type of player than Broxton, but a little similar to me in the way of the big peaks and valleys. And you're either in or you're out on owning Chris Davis, and you own him all season and get your hopefully 40 home runs and live with the highs and the lows. And to me, Broxton's the same way. Like, he's a player who could hit 100 one week, and if you bench him, the next week he might hit 2 home runs and steal 3 bases. So, I mean, in his career, he has 495 plate appearances. That's still a little bit below a typical full-season workload. And he has 20 home runs and 35 steals. Like, you can't, even in a shallow league, the way steals are at a premium right now, you can't turn your back on someone who has 20 homers and 35 steals in basically a full season of career work. So, I mean, I think you just put him in your lineup and you ride it out. I can't even decide if he's hot or cold this month, because this month he has 5 home runs, which is great. But he's also hitting around 200 and hasn't stolen a, I think he's 1 steal this month, so, which isn't good. So I think you just ride it out. I would rather own him than the first baseman, I think, that we've been talking about, just because we typically need steals. Do you,
right.
Would you rather have all those first basemen, or would you rather just ride the wave with Broxton?
I mean, to some extent, it depends what I need, because, again, you talk about a guy like Smoke, a guy like Bohr in particular, and I'm just really high on him. I've watched the Marlins a lot in the last week, and you notice, man, the top 6 in that lineup is really, really good. It's deep, and Bohr is a legitimate young-ish power guy in that lineup. So, you know, if I needed homers and RBI, I have a lot of faith that Bohr continues to produce that, whereas, you know, Broxton, who knows? So I think to some extent it's kind of what you need. Do you need a lottery ticket? In which case you take Broxton and you hope that he's hot more than not over the next 3.5 months and you get, you know, 20 home runs and 25, 30 steals. I mean, that it wouldn't be shocking if you got that. So, you know, I think in that regard, if I want a lottery ticket, I want Broxton. But if I'm just looking to gain in particular categories, say home run and RBI, I'm looking at somebody like Bohr. Though, you know, I think the difference is that the level of frustration with Broxton and the ugliness of the batting average, I don't know. You probably have the numbers in front of you. I don't know, but I suspect that Broxton is an easier guy to get your hands on right now than Bohr.
And he is, and that's like, he's still available in more than half of the Yahoo leagues. And even if I didn't need steals, I think I would pick up Broxton, and maybe you can swing a different trade and get rid of a different base stealer. You can never have too many steals right now.
Yeah. Time to drop Troy Tulowitzki. He has been out and out bad in virtually every way that a fantasy player would care about whether you're any good.
Yeah, I mean, I think it has to be. I mean, like, at least in 10-team leagues for sure, in 12-team leagues, I think also for sure, in 15-team leagues, you probably keep him, but, well, you would keep him because you just, there is some ceiling there, but yeah, he's been bad this year. He has a 630 OPS. He's not hitting for average or power. And then you start thinking about, this: is this a slumping star or not? And this isn't Carlos Gonzalez to me, who's a slumping star. Like last year, Trullo, he did hit 24 home runs, but he had a 254 average. He doesn't steal bases anymore. Really, since he got to Toronto, he's basically a 240 to 250 hitter with a bit of power, no base stealing ability. I think at that point, the ceiling's low enough that, yeah, I think in 10 and 12 team leagues, he needs to be dropped. Would you drop him in 12 team formats?
Yeah, I think so. I think so, especially considering something we've talked about a lot, which is it's not like there's a real shortage of guys to replace him. That's a position where you can get help now. So, I don't think that's unreasonable at all.
He's also way down the lineup, and that's like he's regularly hitting sixth or seventh. So, I mean, it's not even like he's hitting right behind Josh Donaldson, and you say, okay, when he heats up, you know, there's big potential here. With him hitting sixth or seventh, like, the potential for him to drive in and score runs is pretty mediocre.
Yep. We move to starting pitchers, and Jacob Faria has been really good. He was really good at AAA before getting called up. His previous minor league record is not that great. It was not bad. It's just not up to the level of this, so it's a little bit of a surprising breakout. Is he at least a stream option in even the shallowest leagues? Are you picking him up everywhere?
Yeah, I am. I made a concerted effort to get him everywhere that I could. Now, I'm typically in deeper leagues, so that wasn't as big of a deal for me. But, yeah, I made an effort to get him everywhere I could because he's striking out a lot of batters. His control's been good. When we go back and look at his AAA stats this season, he was also striking out a lot of batters. So I know he doesn't have the name value coming up of like a Jose Barrios or a Julio Urias or someone like that, but this is someone who was really dominant in AAA and has been really dominant now in a few starts in the majors. And with the need for pitching, I just, even in the shallowest of leagues, I don't see how someone could turn their back on him. Like, would you go ahead and grab him, you know, just drop your worst pitcher almost, like, no matter who it was, even in a shallow format for him?
Well, let's use an exact example. In my 10-team office league, probably my most droppable starter is Jimmy Nelson. Do you drop Jimmy Nelson for Jacob Faria? And I think if he's still sitting there, the answer is probably yes, though I'm not sure that's an easy call because there are some weeks where you look at Nelson's matchups and you like them a lot.
It's true, but I think I would make the move. That's a tough one. Maybe you drop your worst hitter then. I don't know.
Yeah.
That would be, who's your worst hitter at that point, or your most droppable hitter, I guess. That's the other question. Like, maybe you drop that person. I don't know. Like, maybe you pick him up and then try to make a 2-for-1 somewhere else to get Jimmy Nelson back on your roster. But I think he has to be owned.
Yeah. How high are you on Alex Meyer?
Not very. And I'm hoping maybe you can talk me into being higher on him. Like, he's had a nice little stretch here, and I know there's strikeout potential, but I don't think he's someone who can keep all those moving parts together and like consistently, you know, have quality starts. Do you think I'm missing the boat on him? Because this is a year, like I just said, where you should kind of jump on someone who's pitching well, but I don't feel like jumping on him. Do you think I'm missing it?
No, I'm not really. Like, I like the strikeout rate, but, you know, to keep hammering on something I always hammer on, this guy's got 50 walks in 74 big league innings. He's got 30 walks in 46 innings this year. Those guys, to me, it's not that you can't be effective pitching that way. You can, and if you were, you know, he's really limited hits, but even with it limiting hits, he's still got a 1-4 whip. But even that isn't exactly what worries me. What worries me, and again, I hammer on this all the time, is that guys who walk a lot of batters, to me, the risk is when it goes bad, it goes terrible. If you're giving up free base runners, then when you do get into trouble and you miss some spots and you allow some doubles and some home runs, those are turning into disaster starts. And those are, when you're talking about stream options, you know, one of the things you're always going to worry about, or you're talking about last start or those kind of ads, one of the things you worry about is, what is the likelihood that this guy just utterly destroys my ratios? And that's my worry with Meyer. It's not that he can't get you some strikeouts. It's what's the risk that he's going to do to you if you pick him up.
Mm-hmm. And with him pitching, like, he's in the American League. He's on a team without a great, you know, group of relievers, without a great lineup. Even with Mike Trout, they're an okay lineup. Without him, they're not a very good one. So it's not even like he's in a position where he can have some not great starts and still come away with the win. I'm not interested in 10 or 12 team leagues for now.
Marco Estrada has, believe it or not, a career-high strikeout rate thus far. He has 96 strikeouts in 85 innings. His walk rate, by his standards, is excellent. I am just eyeballing total numbers, so I'm doing the math in my head, but it looks like maybe a career-low, not quite, but even by his standards, a low walk rate. And he is getting punished. And it appears that if anybody is a victim of balls leaving the park, it's Marco Estrada. Whatever it is that is going on, that fly balls are turning into home runs, the guy paying the price is Marco Estrada. And as a result, he's allowed 14 home runs in 85 innings. And as a result of that, he has a 4.98 ERA, which is his highest since he was in Milwaukee the last time he gave up a whole bunch of home runs, when he gave up 29 in 150 innings. So, how worried are we, not just about the rough year Estrada is having and his struggles, but how worried are we that whatever is causing this power spike leaves Estrada particularly vulnerable and means that because of the kind of pitcher he is, it may be extra hard for him to get it back?
Yeah, I'm going to go out on a limb and suggest buying low on him, because his owners are really frustrated right now. And I watch Estrada pitch a lot, and when I step back and really look at his, so really everything's happened in June. Like, when June started, he had a 3.15 ERA. Like, 3.15 is amazing. And he was great last year and great the year before. He's had four really, really bad starts. In those four starts, he's given up five home runs. Now, that's bad for sure. It's not ridiculously bad, but it is bad, especially since the starts were pretty short ones. He's also had incredibly bad batted ball luck this month. Like, his BABIP allowed this month is over 500. So, and I mean, I watched in his last start against Texas, like, he was going along fine. He went into the fourth inning, bottom of the fourth inning, with a 5-1 lead, and he had given up a solo home run in the first, which is actually like a typical Marco Estrada start. He gives up a home run early in the game, and then he settles in, and he's fine. And in that inning, he walked two batters, which is trouble, and he had two outs. And then I forget who it was on the Rangers, hit the ball about 15 feet. And it just fell between everybody, and next thing you know, the bases are loaded, and then he got a ground ball from Elvis Andrus that missed Tulowitzki's glove by about 3 inches, and two runs scored, and then things just unraveled from there. John Gibbons says he's just missing his spots, which is a big deal for someone who doesn't throw hard, but I do believe he can get himself back on track. I would for sure bench him right now, but I'm not dropping him yet, and a lot of people are asking me if they should drop him. Would you drop him, Matthew, even in your 10-team league?
I haven't yet. I'm sure thinking about it, but I haven't yet. But, you know, one of the things I look at, and this is probably kind of silly, but one of the things I look at when I'm thinking about dropping somebody is what percentage owned is he? That is, it kind of comes back to something you often talk about. Could you get him back? I'm not sure I'd get him back. I think somebody would take a flyer on him, and so, you know, that's part of what weighs into my not being quite ready to drop him yet. Now, I will say, another rough one, because this weekend coming up should be pretty favorable. He's at the Royals. That seems like it should be a pretty good matchup for him. Are you starting Estrada in Kansas City? I know you just said in general you're benching him, but given that that seems like a pretty friendly matchup, are you starting him in Kansas City, and what does it do to your worry level if that one goes bad as well?
Yeah, that one would make me worry more. So I have him locked into my lineup in a couple of weekly transaction leagues, and there's nothing I can do. So he's going to stay in my lineup in those. I think in a daily league, just for the safety of it all, like, the four starts have been really bad. I think I would just bench him and take my chances. I'll feel bad if I miss a seven-inning gem, but I don't know if we're going to go right back to there right away. So I think I would bench him for at least a start in pretty much every league where I could. But if that was a bad start, I still don't think I would quite drop him yet. He went bad for a while last year, but that was all associated with a back injury, and they didn't announce it right away. Now, they've said that there's nothing wrong with him physically right now, so we'll take their word for it. But I don't know. I think I'm going to give him – there's only a couple weeks left, really, till the All-Star break. I think I'm going to kind of give him those couple weeks and see where I'm at with him, unless I really had to race out for someone I loved on waivers, like Jacob Freya. I mean, that would be – when we were talking about that, you said your least valuable pitcher was probably Jimmy Nelson. Like, you might hit a point with someone like Estrada where – he becomes your least valuable, and you do decide to move him for an exciting rookie.
We will move on to closers in just a moment. Before we do, I want to take a minute to tell you about the MLB Pipeline podcast, which focuses on all things draft and prospect related. MLB Pipeline's draft and prospect gurus, Jim Callis and Jonathan Mayo, join Tim McMaster each week to talk about what's going on in the universe of MLB's future stars. Last week's episode, as you might expect, was a full breakdown of the 2017 MLB draft, with Jonathan and Jim naming their personal favorite selections from each of the first five rounds. Search for MLB Pipeline in iTunes or wherever else you get your podcasts and click subscribe. Not a lot we can still say about these guys other than they are the best at what they do and you should listen to what they have to say.
That's right, especially this time of year when this type of information is kind of like when these prospects are, we've already talked about a couple of really big ones and there'll be more on their way.
We move on to closers, and Cleveland seems like a weird situation. I suspect that it reverts to normal really quickly, and I think Andrew Miller's value is still a great pitcher who might get an occasional save. Do you put any more stock in this little bit of shuffling and this comment from Terry Francona about them shifting roles than I do?
No, I think I'm pretty much a hold on Miller and on Cody Allen. Maybe if I was a Miller owner, I would see if I could trade him for more value right now, maybe than he's worth. Like, Miller's quite valuable, but he'd be obviously a lot more valuable if he was getting a lot of saves. So I think maybe I'd at least shop him a little bit right now as a potential closer, but I agree with you. I think it reverts back to Allen for the most part at some point. So I feel like I'm pretty much a hold on him. If I'm an Allen owner, I'm not selling low on him. And if I'm looking to trade for saves, I guess maybe there's a window where if you were looking to trade for saves, maybe a panicked Allen owner would trade him at a discount. That may be the one window I could see.
The Angels situation has taken another turn. Bud Norris on the DL. Bedrosian not installed just yet. David Hernandez got a save chance. Houston Street due back possibly today as we record this. I'm not picking up anybody until I know what they're doing. Bedrosian owned in a lot of leagues anyway. I think a lot of people were stashing him, but I am not picking up Street or Hernandez just yet. Bedrosian seems like the only guy you would even think about adding just because I think he's the best pitcher of those three guys. Do you like any of them particularly, or is that still kind of a hands-off until you get a better read?
Yeah, mostly a hands-off. I think in 10-team leagues, it's a hands-off. In 12-team, I could see picking up Bedrosian at least. I pick up Bedrosian in a 12-team league for a week and then just see where we're at. Now, you and I were both kind of wrong with Bud Norris, where we kind of laughed at the beginning of the thought of him being a successful closer. And then he was, and up until the point he went on the DL. I feel the same way about David Hernandez. I'm not interested in picking him up, even if he gets their next save or two. And I'm not a Houston Street believer. When he comes back immediately, I'd want to see it before I believe it. So mostly avoid, but in a deep league, I would pick up Bedrosian and just kind of see how they use him. I know they didn't use him in a safe situation right away. That being said, he did just come back. So, and I know some managers like to, especially because this isn't Mariano Rivera, like they kind of like to work some of these guys back in an earlier inning before they throw them out in the ninth.
We move to the two start pitchers, and there are some guys I like quite a bit. There's somebody I drafted really high in score sheet on this list. That's a little disconcerting. Taijuan Walker, home for the Phillies and Cardinals. Eddie Butler at Washington and Cincinnati. Jeff Hoffman at San Francisco and Arizona. Rich Hill, home for the Dodgers and, home for the Angels and at San Diego. Nick Pivetta at Arizona and at Seattle. Tyson Ross at Cleveland and at the White Sox. Michael Wacha, home for the Reds and Nationals. To me, Hill is the easy choice out of those. I like the matchups. I like the pitcher. I am not touching Tyson Ross right now. Hoffman would intrigue me. Those matchups intrigue me. At Arizona is tough, but it's also not home. I don't mind Walker. I'm just not an Eddie Butler guy at all. How do you like this list?
Yeah, I like this list more than some of them. I agree that Hill's an easy one, and I wanted to include him just because I think there are a lot of owners who have been benching him because he hasn't pitched very well, but I think this is your chance to put him back out there and see how he does. Yeah, I like Walker. I know their home starts and his park's not friendly for pitchers. That being said, Arizona really rakes at home, so he could pick up wins even with just six inning, three run type starts. I've decided I don't think Eddie Butler's maybe a great pitcher. I was kind of hopeful that with the Cubs he would get on track, but I don't think it's happening. I would use Hoffman in most leagues. I would use Pivetta in 12 team leagues for sure, because the striking batter's out. So you might get 15 strikeouts in those two starts. I wouldn't use Roth. I agree with you on that. And Waka, the home starts are nice for a Cardinals pitcher, and with the Reds, and but the Nationals are tough. And Waka just hasn't pitched that well. I would not use him in a 10-team league. And I'm kind of on the fence in a 12-team format. I thought he was going to have a good year, and I don't really trust him right now.
Yeah, I worry that Waka may just be broken, and I hope I'm wrong. He's a guy I really liked watching pitch, but he just has not been very good in general lately. It's a string of, well, I'm looking at this, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. He's basically got one good start in his last six, and you know, that was at home against the Phillies. His last good start before that was at home against the Giants. So maybe, you know, you find good matchups and, you know, maybe. And those aren't terrible matchups, but the Nats can rake. I mean, at home is not bad. But, yeah, I just can't trust him at all. I just think he's not right. Maybe not even physically. I'm not saying he's not right physically. I just think he's not right. And I can't get on board for a guy that I have really liked as a pitcher, but I don't see it right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. And his strikeout upside's fairly low. So
right. Yes.
Yeah,
that's the thing. His upside is ratios, and those are bad, and that makes for a really tough ad.
Mm-hmm.
That is the Fantasy 411 this week. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Thanks, Fred Zinke, for taking the time to talk. We will talk to you all again in a week.